Hello, welcome to Akbar's Chamber. I'm your host, Niall Green. And in this episode, we're going to be visiting the South Indian village of Gugudu. And we're going to be learning there what kind of religiosity has allowed Muslims and Hindus to live side by side for centuries. The village of Gugudu is in the South Indian state of Andhra Pradesh. It has a population of less than 2,000 people, of whom only around 10% are Muslim. The remaining 90% of the population are Hindus, or indeed outcasts, or Dalits, as we now call them. And yet the types of religiosity, the religious practices, the local religion that has evolved over centuries in Gugudu is revolved around a shared set of rituals and a shared set of holy places. In particular, the shrine to a Sufi saint called Kulyapa. The name Kulyapa literally means the saint with the Muslim cap, and he's regarded by villagers as the founder of the village of Gugudu. But not only did he found the village, and indeed various of the local castes, the people who inhabit it, but he also is believed to have founded a particular type of devotional religiosity that unifies Hindus and Muslims. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Professor Afsar Muhammad. He's a senior lecturer in South Asian studies at the University of Pennsylvania and is the author of a book about Gugudu and its religiosity entitled The Festival of Peers, Popular Islam and Shared Devotion in South India, which is published by Oxford University Press in 2013. Hello, Afsar. Welcome to Akbar's Chamber.
Hi, Niall. So happy to see you here, and then so happy to be on Akbar's Chamber.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you here and to be talking about your home region in India and your book based upon your research, your ethnographic research in the village of Gugudu in Andhra Pradesh in south central India, something like that, southern India. This is a village of around 2,000 people, not a particularly large village, but the Muslim population is about 10%. And as you'll be telling us more fully, this has produced this blended, mixed religiosity of a local or indeed a localized Islam, in which there's a shared set of devotional practices between Hindus and Muslims in this village of Gugudu. But of course, that's what you're going to be telling us about. So I should sort of wrap up my intro there, Afsar, and ask you if you can introduce us to the village of Gugudu and take us on a tour of its sacred spaces and tell us about those sacred spaces as they're understood by the village's Muslim and Hindu inhabitants.
Great, great. That's a good beginning, actually, Niall. So the making of this Gugudu as a sacred site, it has something to do with this hybrid religiosity. So it is not just an Islamic site. Of course, if I say Islamic, that would be debatable category. But it also has a lot of Hindu sites, particularly Saiva and Vaishnava sites. And then also the village has this folk goddess tradition, very powerful folk goddess tradition. It is like just like any South Indian village. But the emphasis on this local saint, Muslim saint, whom they call Peer, and then Kulayappa. Kuhala plus Appa. That is how it came. So Kuhala means cap in Farsi. Appa is god and lord or father in South India. So it's a combination of Kuhala plus Appa means the god with a cap. So that symbolizes two big ideas in Islam and again Hinduism, right? So when it comes to these sacred spaces, people who visit the shrine of this local peer, they also go to these Shaiva, Vaishnava, and folk goddess shrines. But they're not that popular as the peer's shrine. But still, they consider it like an important ritual. So they finish their tour, devotional tour, starting with those shrines and conclude at the Kulayappa shrine. So there is, I believe, a kind of hierarchy there when it comes to even sacred spaces and their worship. So people kind of basically, it doesn't matter whether they are there might be any caste group. So they initially like follow this procedure very religiously. So that is quite interesting. Of course, Muslims, they don't follow the same procedure as Hindus because Muslims, they just believe in the Sufi peer. So they don't even visit these local Hindu shrines. So there is that minor difference is there. But when they come to the shrine, Sufi shrine, which is called Pir Makan, so Pir house, Makan is Urdu, and then they telugize it that as making it a vowel ending, Makanam. So Pir house. So that is the local usage for this shrine. So when they come to this Pir house, both Hindus and Muslims, they follow same rituals. And of course, stories differ. So we have like Shaiva stories, Vaishnava stories, Dalit stories, Dalit untouchable stories, and Muslim stories. So stories differ, but the rituals, they are the same. So that is one thing I actually wanted to talk about throughout my work. Just like how or where the Hindu rituals end, where the Muslim rituals begin, and then how these two religious systems interact with each other. So what kind of dialogue is going on there? So which is very important considering the contemporary setting in South Asia and elsewhere as well. So that way the story is particularly like of course Muslims are still minority in this village, very like very small community. So but during the month of Muharram, their number is more. Yet when considering the other people like Hindu communities, caste groups, Muslims are still minority. Even pilgrims also like very minor, like they are very small in number. But the ritual system basically like since at the shrine, they follow Islamic devotional system. So reciting the verses from Quran and also like the administration part of the shrine, it is still like Muslims kind of take good control of it. But Muslim means in this context, we need to also understand there is a caste system even among Muslims here. So the subcaste called Dudhe Kula, the cotton carders caste, which is very popular in this region. So they take care of the rituals. So they are between, these Dudekula caste is like a liminal kind of identity. They are half between Hindus and then Hinduism and Islam. So there is this in-betweenness, even in administration. And then I think that actually defines the entire nature of sacred spaces. So the around this village, we can see a lot of Shaiva shrines.
Okay, yeah, shrine to the Hindu god Shiva.
Right. So, of course, we can talk about it later. There is a huge Sufi shrine, Anuganda, which is called as the entry point of Sufism in South India. But that's a different story. But a lot of people from there also come here.
Right. So, yeah, so we'll be talking about Gugudu village as a pilgrimage center too. But, yeah, just staying with the village itself for now, you've given us this sense of what we have here is a religiosity that's developed within a particular geographical setting, the village, with its distinctive sociological setting too. I mean, of course, we all start out with these shorthand simplifications, Muslims and Hindus. But of course, as anyone knows who's ever spent any time within India, particularly outside of, let's say, big cities, but regardless, it's often said that there are many Hindu religions. Of course, there are various Hindu castes. There are many, many Hindu deities that are related to the different caste groups. And of course, there are, in different regions of India, there are many, many different castes and subcastes as well. So religiosity among Hindus is often defined by caste, by language, by region, and indeed by, let's say, rural or village versus kind of city distinctions as well. And similarly with Muslims too, we have the regional variations of let's say the sociology of Muslims in India. We have actually caste, Muslim caste or Baradari, but let's say caste-like affiliations or indeed castes among Muslims in India, but also in Pakistan and Bangladesh. And of course, yeah, too, we also have the linguistic distinctions too. So just as actually on the ground for so much Hindu religiosity, religious expression, of course, the Brahmin might be reciting certain Sanskrit texts, but often the religiosity is expressed, the religious imagination is through the local language, in this case, the language Telugu. And indeed for Muslims too, we have, as you've noted, and we'll talk about a little bit more about the terminology you brought up. This is a terminology that isn't the terminology of Arabic, of the Quran. It's partly a mix of a bit of Persian words, some Urdu words, but they're brought into, as you've explained for us, the local Telugu language, the local language of these Muslims, and particularly of the Muslims belonging to the caste of the professional caste of cotton workers, cotton carders. So just to clarify for listeners, these key terms you've given us, this pir, which is the old Sufi Persian word, originally meant an elder, but it's used for a saint, a Muslim holy man in the Eastern Islamic world and indeed in India as well. And we have this, I suppose, a Persian Urdu term, the Pir Makan, which is what the shrine is called. But as you've explained, it's absorbed into Telugu by giving a Telugu suffix at the end of the word. And as you've explained, then the village itself, we have a sacred space then that isn't competing sacred space. It's not mosque versus shrine, or mosque and shrine versus Shiva shrine, or temple, Vaishnava temple, temple to Vishnu. These are brought into, I suppose, a kind of a unified sacred space rather than competing sacred space, albeit in which Muslims and Hindus might visit them differently, but they follow the same ritual customs, particularly at the house of the saint, the house of the Sufi saint. And that Sufi saint is this figure then, the pir, is this figure you've mentioned, Kuliyappa.
Right.
So to come back to you, Afsar, can you introduce us to the peer, the saint Kulyapa, who's at the center of devotion or bhakti, this word that you've used in your book, the word often used in Indian languages for devotional religion. So can you introduce us to the peer Kulyapa, who is followed, who's so many Muslim and Hindu villages are devoted to, as well as, of course, as we'll come on to that, pilgrims from beyond the village of Gugudu come there. So, yeah, who is Peer Kulyapa in short?
Yes, that's always a big question. But I believe it's not easy to explain. Because one historically speaking, most Sufi shrines in this region and also around, so they actually go back to 15th century.
Hmm.
So there is a story, popular story, that Kulyapa actually appeared in like around 15th century in this village. So they just say that the story, popular story, says that it's a saint with a cap, Muslim cap, appeared there and performed prayer, namaz, in this place. So a lot of stories speak about how he introduced Sufi concepts, beginning with simple and then to complicated concepts.
Mm.
Like Niyya as a personal, like pure intention. And then, of course, they use Telugu equivalent Niyatu.
Right.
And then Baraka, again, like grace. So Barakat, Barakatu in Telugu. So they just make a vowel ending.
Blessing, I guess. Yeah, that's a
right.
Kind of Arabic term.
Make it vowel ending. So the most stories basically speak about the Sufi concepts. And they also speak about how this peer, he created a new village.
Mm.
So there was a village before his arrival, but that was gutted down.
Right.
There was some fire and then it was totally destroyed. And then when Kulyapa arrived in this village, the story tells that, okay, this is this new village. So they also like make a distinction between this old village and then new village. So old village, this is where we see a lot of Hindu shrines in old village.
Right.
And then when Kulyapa arrived, and then that space, that it is clear distinction there, like between old and new. And then that space has become a new village. And then that is where the Sufi tradition begins in this village. So that way, they also clearly distinguish between old practices and new practices. So old practices are gone. Kulyapa brought new mode of worship. And this is a combination still of, like in Sufism, like some abstract concepts. And then in Hinduism, we have these concrete concepts like object worship. And then Kulyapa actually represents both sides. So we have abstract and then concrete modes of worship. So the entire hagiography speaks about, of course, there are also teachings, very popular in folk songs, oral narratives, but the big story actually comes from creating this new village that gradually became pilgrim center. As according to this story, Kulyapa traveled extensively around this region, and then encouraged Hindu. That category might like little like debatable even now, of course, at that point as well. These different caste groups, local caste groups, and then he encouraged them to embrace Sufism, peer worship. So that is like a, but in the teachings, basically like cover both Hindu bhakti notions and then Sufi ibadat worship. And then within this big story, Kulayappa, of course, still at the center, but there is more focus on his teachings that blend different religions, different devotional systems, rituals, and then stories. And then there was the story also tells that he actually introduced this worship method, how to worship at a Sufi shrine. Then what are the components of Sufi worship? So the story goes like this. So Kulayappa actually, like as his name suggests, God with a cap. So cap being Islamic, and then appa meaning South Indian idea of God, Lord. So that is the only difference. Even though Muslims also use the same term, Kulayappa, but in a Muslim kind of community narrative, you don't see they worshipping Kulayappa as equal to God, because that is un-Islamic, right?
Yes,
So
yeah, that.
they still stick to that idea. Their stories are a little different. Like for them, Kulayappa is a mediator.
Like so many of the peers, the Sufi, the saints are in
Right.
devotional Islamic tradition and Sufi tradition. And so this is so interesting, this figure Kulyapa. But tell us, so is Kulyapa, I'm trying to sort of, I suppose, oversimplify, maybe even divide something that the whole point of this devotional religiosity is maybe the ambiguity of Kulyapa's identity. But is he regarded as being a Muslim that he's come from there, or is his identity, his religious affiliation, is it more ambiguous, or is it clear that the Kulyapa is a peer, he's a Sufi, he's a Muslim?
So there is no confusion about his identity. Every story basically says, oh yeah, he was Muslim. He had these Sufi beginnings. But the most important thing is there. So Kulayappa is considered to be the eldest in the prophet's family. So this is very, this historically speaking, I don't, that stands for any, like, there is any evidence. But it's a story, basically. They all believe that he was the, like, Muharram, it's connected to Muharram practices, right? Well, Muharram is, as everybody knows, it's like a memorialization of martyrdom of Hussein, right? So Hussein, like central in the story of Muharram,
Yeah, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad.
right? But in this story, not Hussein, but Kulayappa, he's like older than Hussein. So
Fascinating.
according to this story, local story, not Hussein, but Kulayappa led the Battle of Karbala. And then then comes a minor like change in the story, because he was he came to this village, and then to protect the community of this village from some evil forces, which were symbolized in the fire. So he martyred in the outskirts of the village.
Right, okay, he was killed, he was martyred
so there
outside.
is this outskirts, that space is called Karbala, local Karbala.
Okay, the
So they
battlefield in Iraq, people would normally think,
they
yeah.
also create that local Karbala where they perform final rites for Kulayappa and other like prophets' family members.
This is truly fascinating and extraordinary. So, yeah, we have Kulayappa then as being understood locally, as you've explained to us, as being the eldest son or the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad's family. So he's related then back to the beginnings of Islam, but crucially, as you've told us, that he's also the founder figure of the village of Gugudu. There was an earlier village elsewhere, this old village, but he founds this new village, and moreover, he founds, in some sense, the local caste group. So he's a sort of an urban founder figure, a kind of sociological kind of founder figure, a social founder figure. And also he's introducing forms of religiosity then. So he's a religious founder as well. But what's so striking, of course, is as you explained to us more fully, that although he's clearly identified as a Muslim, the majority population, 90% of the village of Gugudu, or Hindus or casteless peoples, or Dalits, as we often call them, but they still nonetheless venerate the shrine and indeed the person of Kulayappa through the same ritual shared by Muslims. But as you pointed out, there are these subtle, let's say, village theologies, which I don't mean to denigrate them. I mean, I just mean theology is theological thinking among villagers, which is subtle enough to say, well, the Muslims say, well, we're not worshipping him because we only worship Allah. We're still Muslims and that's ibadat. We only give for Allah. We hear this is the paying our respects or seeking the barakah, the blessing, the intercession of Pir Kulayappa. Whereas for local Hindus and Dalits, it's in the language of bhakti, of a devotional type of Hindu religiosity that also in other regions of India, because your work is so fascinating as such a detailed case study. But I think it's important for our listeners to recognize Gugudu is unique, of course, in various ways, but this kind of activity, this kind of shared religiosity happens all over rural India, really, among Muslims and Hindus. So, yeah, this is altogether fascinating because it's so unique and extraordinary, but it's also typical of a type of religiosity across India that for centuries has joined local Hindus and Muslims together in these forms of what you've called localized religiosity. But I wonder if we can turn now to the rituals then, you know, kind of we've got our key figures, we've understood the village and we've understood Pir Kulayappa himself, the saint with the cap, as you've nicely translated his name. But can you describe for us, Afsar, the rituals that take place in Gugudu during the Muslim holy month of Muharram that you've mentioned, that usually commemorates the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandchildren, Hassan and Hussein. But we have these rituals there during the month of Muharram that is especially termed locally then this festival of Pirs, as you've translated it, the Pirla Pandaga in Telugu, and that also has these firewalking displays that are called Fakiri.
Right. So the ritual framework, Nayan, it is like the regular framework from the public events of Muharram. So Muharram is like each day is devoted to one family member, right? But of course, there are certain days which are like 7th day and 10th day, which are big in the rituals of Muharram, whether you are performing these rituals in urban space or metropolitan space or rural space. So the framework remains same. But what happens, particularly in this village, is like because they want to highlight local peer Kulayappa and then privilege his story. So the most rituals, and then song performances, story performances. They are centered on him basically. So they basically they try to like that is for them, Kulayappa remains a major source of Sufi inspiration and then prophetic tradition. So that's a blend of both prophetic tradition and Sufi practices. So that is the reason why in this region, Muharram is called Pirla Pandaga. Pirs, and then Pandaga means festival. So of course, there is a debate about whether you could use that term festival or not. Because festival, when you use that term, there is some element of joy, right? Celebration. But ordinary villages, devotees, whether they are Muslims or Hindus, they all believe that this is not about celebration. This is just a memorialization of Prophet's family and Kulayappa. But the performances, because you know, we have this in South Indian context, when there is a big public event, they have a very specific festival framework. So it becomes festival when it like in practice. But when you look at the rituals, those rituals are sorrowful. Whether they are doing it on first day or 10th day. 10th day is in Islamic terminology, they use Shahadat. So, but in
The
this
martyrdom,
context, right,
the day of the martyrdom on the 10th day, Ashura.
So they use like even though they use different terminology, sometimes they use Urdu terminology like that last day they call Akhri. Akhri is a Urdu term, but they make it vowel ending by saying Akhri. So rituals are like 10 days rituals. Each day, the first day begins with the installation of these symbols, hand-shaped symbols, what we call in urban context, tazia. So the icons, basically. So then, second day, third day, they have different rituals like storytelling, art folk performances, and then difference, particularly seventh day and 10th day are important. Seventh day they do khasim memorialization, and 10th day they do Hussein's memorialization, and then it is Kulayappa's memorialization as well. So other rituals like as I mentioned before, there are Saiva, Vaishnava, and folk goddess shrines as well. So Hindus, different caste groups from Hindus, they go to Saiva, Vaishnava, and folk goddess shrines, and then they do regular Hindu puja kind of services there. So for them, it is important. Like, okay, it's kind of how that the pilgrimage won't be complete unless they perform those rituals for Hindu gods and goddesses. But the final destination still remains Kulayappa's shrine. So
And
from
the
there,
ceremony,
so Kulayappa's like visitation, what they call they use blend, they blend like hybrid vocabulary. Ziyarat, Islamic, like visitation, and darshan is a Hindu term. So, Ziyarat, darshan is a hybrid vocabulary. There's a lot of hybrid vocabulary in the usage here. Like, they use Fatiha, like which is typically Islamic ritual, and then puja. Fatiha puja. Puja is Hindu worship, right? So, worship service in the peer house, it is called Fatiha Puja. So this lot of such vocabulary is there that also tells so much about how hybrid are these practices. So the hybridity and then pluralism, that is the term I want to use and then emphasize. That is the term I actually emphasize it in my work as well. So the pluralist notion of devotionalism is always at the center of this local Mohram.
That's so interesting because we've got this sense that as we'll come on to in the next part of our discussion, we'll talk about how reformers, religious reformers, Muslim and Hindu from outside the village of Gurgaon, indeed from in other regions too, Muslim and Hindu urban reformers would see these villages that they're misled. They don't know what their religion is. They don't know what real Hinduism is. They don't know what real Islam is, etc. But what you're actually kind of showing us is actually the villagers, and indeed the 300,000 pilgrims from the surrounding rural regions that come to for the festival of Pirs or the commemoration of Pirs, the Pila Pandaga. They have quite a sense of what is. They have quite a sense of, really, in a sense, deliberately combining, as you said, sort of hybridizing, combining their theologies, what's theirs, what's not, and how they're incorporating them. And that's this kind of use of language quite self-consciously, as you said, the Muslim word for pilgrimage, ziyarat, brought together with
That's
the traditional Sanskritic word for looking upon a god, a statue, or a holy figure, the darshan. And those words are deliberately brought together, and similar Fatiha, of course, as you will know as well as I do, it's the opening, it literally is the opening surah of the Quran, the opening, and the recitation of that is the Fatiha ritual. But that's been joined together, as you said, puja, the Sanskritic Hindu term for ritual, for worship. So there's this real self-conscious sense of people know what they're doing theologically. They know they're quite conscious in the way they're creating a local, a religion that actually works, that functions harmoniously with, as you said, pluralism, the facts on the ground that there's a Muslim minority living among a Hindu majority. And yet this has created a kind of a pluralistic theology, a pluralistic religious landscape, and a level of pluralistic harmony of people living side by side for, well, these 500 years, as you said, since Pir Kulyapa came to the village, or indeed founded the village of Gugudu. But as I mentioned, and as you talk about in your book too, that as throughout India, and indeed throughout the wider regions of Muslim population, the Muslim world, or indeed wherever Muslims live, there have been many, of course, reformist critiques of this type of religiosity, whether Sufi religiosity in general, or this particular village level religiosity and local idioms, Telugu or whichever other regional languages. So how have these expressions of local Islam, if I can call it that, there in Gugudu, have they become the focus of theological and ritual critiques by perhaps outsiders, or in some cases, perhaps even villagers who've tried to reform the religious practices in the village of Gugudu?
Right. So there is, as I noticed during my field research, and also I also like found that during my re recent trip to this place. So there is always a tension there between the actual rituals and stories performed by these villagers and pilgrims. And there is this new generation of Muslims right now. Like we can say, like 20 plus age group generation. So they are more influenced by Arabic and Urdu language centered religious texts. So they just started studying the Quran, Hadith, and all, like, because you know, there are also like vernacular texts available now. So the same year when I was doing my field research in this village, not in this village but around the region, I have collected 200 plus texts published in Telugu language
Right.
that speak about Islam and then highlight the idea of pure Islam, which is
Right.
called
So let's say reformist texts, then why the ideas of religious reform from other regions, other languages, other cities, let's say, yeah, kind of coming into Telugu. That's interesting.
So they are actually reading those texts and then trying to promote that version of Islam, which is called pure Islam, true Islam, Asli Islam is the local term for that. So this Asli Islam, basically, they stick to this normative framework of Islam, like five times prayer, then Friday obligatory prayers, and then fasting. So for them, rather than Muharram, Ramadan is the most important event. So they try to come up with all these ideas. So that is what I was trying to say. That's just another version of global Islam, what I call localized Islam. So there is a certain process to localize those global concepts of Islam, what we can call five pillars or whatever. But the local Islam, which is actually there in the field, that the living Islam, which both Muslims and Hindus practice, it is like gradually there is a growing rift between these two ideas. Of course, there is a generational, intergenerational conflict there, and then also growing like importance of Islamic education, and then also the growing importance of mosque-centered practices. So there is a tension between mosque versus dargah, this Sufi shrine. So it's actually everywhere now, actually. It's not just specific for this village. It's even you see that in urban spaces as well. So where you have this new generation Muslims talking about Asli Islam, while Sufi practices are still popular out there. But my idea is how do we understand this like two systems opposing each other? So there is actually no dialogue between those two systems. They are quite opposing viewpoints. And then when you enter into these devotional spaces, you immediately recognize that, okay, there are these two types of devotional systems working here, right? But still, out of 300,000 people who visit the shrine, these people are not even like 100. So that actually tells something about the impact of that system. It is weak right now. But at some point, what I kind of tried to hypothesize, like guess, is that generation might become a little more powerful.
Yeah.
So the rise of middle class might help them. The growing numbers of mosque worshippers, mosque goers might help them. But by and large, I don't see like it's not going to be that big influence. But they are going to make significant impact locally because they have voice there.
No, so yeah, I mean, I think many readers might be sort of perplexed that well, hang on, don't all Muslims go to mosques? But of course, we have to sort of bear in mind that mosques are a certain type of religious institution. And throughout the history of Islam and the history of Muslim religiosity, many Muslims for many, many regions, for many centuries, their key religious institution is the shrines, as we call them in English, the dargah, the Sufi sites. It's not to say that Muslims don't also pray. Those Muslims might be going to dargahs, and that they might also be you giving the making the more normal namaz, as we'd say in often in South Asia and Urdu in Persian, the salah, the five prayers a day. Maybe they make them all or not. But the key, as you've alluded to, is that it's the institution of the mosque and the particular types of religiosity that modern mosque founders and promoters of the institution of the mosque versus the dargah. Because throughout South Asian history, and indeed the wider Muslim world, many of these shrines have mosques in them. But in a sense, it's the mosque shrine compound. That may not be the case in Gugudu, but this sense of mosques as distinct and opposing a type of another type of Islam that you've called global Islam, reformist Islam. That's yeah, this is in many ways something new, something 20th century, or at least particularly for regions across South Asia. But let me ask you, this younger generation that you've mentioned, the age of 20, I guess they're Generation Y, Gen Y, would we call them in the US or something like that. You mentioned the availability of books on the more what they call Asli Islam, what they call original Islam then, or pure Islam. But of course, it's looking from the outside, it's another version, of course, of Islam that they see or claim to be the pure original Islam. Do this Generation Y in the village, do they also have access to cell phones and the internet and, let's say, online ideas of Islam? So is the sense of this global Islam, as you call it, affecting local religiosity? That's a sort of a two-pronged assault, so to speak. Is it by Telugu books in the local languages as well as the internet?
Yes, internet is also a big source because they access these lectures on Islam on their mobile phones. They listen to the lectures from the religious teachers from different parts of the world, not just in this region, but it's like a global idea, right? So they have access to all these devices, and then they actually try to translate those global ideas into their local context. That is actually also like, I would say, madrasa system, like Islamic madrasa system, schooling system,
Oh, the
is
madrasa system, yeah.
also a big reason why this new generation is trying to cultivate this Asli Islam culture. So they just got these two new tools to understand Islam, and then they feel that that is the better way to understand Islam. And then they also feel that they need to clean up all un-Islamic things from Islamic rituals and then Islamic devotion. So this is it's a huge process. Like it's not working right now, but it's a huge process. And then there are a lot of tools available and the texts, because there is nothing but promoting textual culture of Islam. So all the texts that are published and circulated within this context, they speak about similar idea of normative Islam. So you don't find anything that addresses the local concerns. It is far removed from this local devotional life. That is one big reason why they are like not that much effective when it comes to gathering local audience. Even their sermons, like even Friday sermons, are also like totally different right now. So they are also becoming more textual sermons. So they use this Telugu translations of Arabic and Urdu texts and then use them directly in a mosque. And then bring examples from like global Islam rather than local Islam. So that is where actually the key stays. Actually, that is where they couldn't like address any of the local concerns or questions.
That's so interesting. It's that with the strength of, let's say, this global reformist, more standardized Islam is also, in a sense, its weakness. Because what the sort of situation you described for us in Gugudu, in Andhra Pradesh region of southern India, as in, and it's the same applicable to many other regions of the Muslim world in Africa as well as other regions of Asia, is that these local forms of Islam, they don't have effective spokesmen. Think they don't have people who are, let's say, writing the theology of Gugudu, the local theology based around Pir Kulyapa. They're not writing texts of that are being translated from Telugu, let's say, into Arabic. The translations are coming the other way, from Arabic or Urdu into Gugudu. So from, let's say, textual knowledge is a one-way flow. Institutionally, there's not, let's say, I don't know, let's say, a franchise, so to speak, of the shrine of Pir Kulyapa that many other such shrines, let's say, all over India or internationally, in the way that mosque-based Islam, or indeed madrasas and the curricula, the text that they teach, they can be replicated and expanded ad infinitum into villages like Gugudu. But this local religiosity, whether Gugudu or elsewhere, local Islam of such places, neither linguistically or institutionally, or in terms of having spokesmen, spokesfigures, influencers, since we've mentioned Gen Y or Gen Z or whatever it is now, these local Islams don't have that. But what's really interesting and subtle, that what you've mentioned, Afsar, and the results of your long field work there in Gugudu, is that strength of global Islam is also its weakness, because it's so detached from local concerns on the ground, that those sermons that are translated from Arabic or brought from someone who studied at the madrasa in perhaps another town or city, they're not addressing local concerns, whether local theological concerns or perhaps just local existential concerns, the kind of things that drive the religious life, that drive religious devotion, that have actually driven and generated and sustained the religion of Gugudu, the great festival then of the Pila Pandaga that you described for us.
So Pila Pandaga, I actually emphasized that usage just to give a sense of how local works. So Muharram is a global event, and then within that global context, where do you locate this local event? Why should we study this local event? And then by studying this local event, what do we learn in terms of Islam or in terms of Sufism or in terms of Hindu-Muslim dialogue? So those three things remain crucial for me throughout my study. Even after finishing this work, when I was reflecting, when I reflect on this material, I believe this is so relevant even now, particularly after the rise of Hindu nationalism on one hand, and there is also the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. So within those two like frameworks, for us, it is so important to understand the field. So most materials, they reject the value of this field. They deny by privileging text So, of course, I actually also like enjoy reading scholarship on the Quran, Hadith, and then historical materials related to the Prophet's family, and then theological debates centered on those things. But as a scholar, I also believe that we need to understand the ground reality. What is actually happening there? What do people do in the name of religion? The doing is central. So this place actually gave me that opportunity to understand those acts of devotionalism, the acts of ibadat, devotion, and the acts of Sufism as articulated in everyday life. So I just want to bring that to the discussion table and then see how much we can. Basically, it's a learning process for me. I actually learned so much from this village. And then I still learn whenever I go to these places, meet the people there. I still learn so much from them.
I think that's a great ethic, actually. Yeah, it's not only from books or from universities or madrasas that we can learn. We can learn from, yeah, the good people in villages or elsewhere. And I think it's a really important point that you've articulated. There are so many really important points, Afsar, that on the one hand, yeah, this is a form of religiosity that's allowed Hindus and Muslims to live side by side. There are ups and downs. This isn't a utopia. This is real life with its ups and downs, its local conflicts, etc. Yet people have lived in the same village, as you said, for hundreds of years. And yet, this isn't just, let's say, a conveniently practical type of religiosity that's been dreamt up by the state so that people can live side by side on some watered down artificial religiosity in the name of communal harmony. For the local people over centuries, this is true religion. This is true dharma. This is true Islam. This is true religiosity. It's not something fake or phony. The outsiders might say they're bringing in the asli, the real Islam. But for the people of Gugudu, the Muslims of Gugudu who've been there for centuries, this is actually, this is real. And the point that you've made is real because it's rooted in localities, in their place, in their lives, in their language. I think that's you expressed it far more beautifully than I did, but I'm just really hoping to amplify the importance and profundity of what you've said. So let me come to our usual short closing question, Afsa. What general lesson do you think emerges from your ethnographic study of the village of Gugudu about what you've called in your book local and localized Islam?
Yes, that is like because this is a small place, so but lessons are great from this small place, so they contribute so much to our understanding of Islam. To understand them better, I use these two categories: local Islam and localized Islam. So localized Islam being global Islam, and local means real local
Yeah.
in this context. So there is nothing global or nothing localized within that idea. So this is just the things that people do right
That's the
there.
local. The localized is when the global tries to get local, then it's
Right,
localized.
right.
Yeah, okay.
So that is the biggest lesson I took from this small place. So it gave me an opportunity to understand multiple dimensions of local Islam. And then if you want to theorize local Islam, local as a conceptual category, so we have all the components in this village. You have Sufi practices, you have Islamic practices, and then you have Hindu practices. Even within Hindu practices, you have this different distinctive practices that are also related to Dalits and women.
Yeah.
Together, they make it local. I think that is what I took. basically.
This has been such an interesting conversation. I'm sorry, it takes me back also to my own days of field work in India, but never for such a longer extended and expert study that you've made in your book, The Festive of Peers. Professor Afzal Muhammad, thank you so much for speaking to us
Thank
in
you.
Akbar's
Thank
Chamber.
you. Thank you, Naya. For being part of, I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much.